Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And it's welcome back to Bob Parks.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Bob. It's been a while.
Yeah. Oh, hello, Jenny. I hope you're listening at the videos. Hi. Hello to all the sixth form girls. And Miriam, I hope you can get through from Puerto Rico this time.
Right. Who's Jenny?
Jenny is the teacher who's invited me to do a project with the kids at my old grammar school in Southall. And I thought, well, I've got to go back there and unload all my ideas, all the music. You know, I've got a group, Parks and the Recreationals. We do early 60s ballads.
Yeah.
And they're exactly what I was listening to when I was in the sixth form at school at that age. So although it's 93% sort of immigrant children at the school, they're this age. And the point is that they'll be at the exactly same point.
So is Jenny teaching there now?
Yeah, she's the head of art.
I see.
And
okay.
She's Canadian, I think. Showed the deputy head, the movie, which you've seen.
This is your movie called
The R&B Feeling. But just let me put a plug in for William's film, Heated Gloves. It's really good, man. It's really good.
Thank you.
And his personal friend, it's a sort of I don't know, you're a sort of inspiration almost. His outlook on life, his stance that he took.
That was
defiantly.
Maurice Seddon, Captain Maurice Seddon, Royal Signals, retired. Captain Maurice Henry Nacom Urquhart Seddon. I think I've missed one. Frank. I missed the middle name out, but yes. No, thank you, because you were on the front row. You came, and you
didn't know I was coming. Although I told you,
I was
coming.
That's right, actually. Yeah, and suddenly you were there.
So we had a nice chat afterwards.
Yeah,
some of your friends from Leicester.
That's right. Yeah,
and they're really interesting.
Yeah, and it was a good event. Actually, it had a good feeling to it.
It was full up as well.
It was almost totally full, and it got quite a good response. Yeah.
Yeah, well done.
So we shall see.
My film's opening the Southampton Film Week.
Okay.
Tomorrow, Halloween. So I thought, I've got to... You know, when you start the things, you go on a little bit, and then they say, well, there's time to talk to whoever it is afterwards.
Yeah.
So I thought I should doff my hat to the fact that it's Halloween. And I've got this Franciscan monk's cowl, and I've got a full head mask of the Queen. So if I have that underneath the mask, I can't think of anything more horrifying.
Right, so that's your Halloween outfit.
That's my Halloween outfit. And then I'll take it off for the serious bit afterwards. I'll have my white suit.
Oh, right.
Which I saw in this shop. I've been looking for a pure white suit my whole life.
Do you celebrate Halloween? Are you?
No. Actually, although it's an English invention.
Oh.
It started over here a long time ago. But then the Americans took it up, and then it superseded Guy Fawkes Night. No one knows about Guy Fawkes Night hardly now. It's always Bonfire Night.
Yeah,
Now it's all Halloween and trick or treat and all that kind of stuff. So I know, but I wouldn't, as a principal, wouldn't, support it. But I will, because it coincides with my movie, so I'll change my...
So tell me, what's this event? This is in Southampton at a film festival or something?
Yes, they've, for some reason, picked... Well, because I'm local, I suppose. Yeah. They picked it as the opening film for the film week.
Okay.
I went there about 9 or 10 years ago, and it was... The French director, it was the two parts of the Dickens, Little Moll, Little Norrit.
Little Dorrit.
Yeah, I went with my mum to that.
And okay.
It's at the campus, but it's a nice cinema, so I'd be able to get to see it on a
proper
screen.
So is it attached to the art college? Is it something to do with Southampton Art School?
No, it's the Film Week. It's the...
Right.
Which is another... I'm in a group called Making a Scene, which is working with people who have suffered mental illness in Southampton. I meet weekly. Hi, Glenda, if you're listening, by the way. And I should meet up at the film. She said she's going to try and make that. But we've got a film through to that as well.
Right.
So it's a double-pronged attack. And that was how they were introduced to it. But they must have had seen it and heard the reviews or something.
Yeah.
And there's a review coming out in this month's or November's Art Monthly.
Okay.
I've got like a taste of it. I just, because I've been going all over London to try to get a hold of the review, but Foyles will have it in next week. And no one else has got it in.
What, so this is in the forthcoming issue of Art Monthly.
Yeah, look, this is so, a little, this is just a, if I can find the stupid thing.
That's all right.
Oh, I don't know. I wrote it all down carefully and I can't find the page. But yeah, it's this month. And, yeah. Pages, throw them over your head. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, oh, here you go. The result, with Jamie Sutcliffe on the rehabilitation of Bob Parks. The result, this is just an extract, it's an extract of an extract. The result is a peculiar piece of film that managed to downplay the strictures of an analytic biopic in favour of a difficult, melancholic, but ultimately rapturous portrait of the artist, of art's aptitude for the articulation of trauma and its emotional reconciliation. And he wrote in an email to someone, I wrote a piece in response to the fantastic and long overdue documentary of the artist Bob Parks, Marcus Werner Head and Nathaniel Mellers in the new Art Monthly. Go see Parks' film as soon as you get a scheme. It's kind of like a Ben Rivers film, but actually means something and isn't... Can I say the word S-H-I-T-E? Because I know...
No, you spelt it out. That's fine. Yeah, probably best not to...
No, I wouldn't dream
is that. What's that referring to? This insult?
I suppose Ben Rivers films.
Oh, right. Do you know Ben Rivers films?
I've never heard of them. I don't know who he is. But no, I just picked that
all
up.
Right.
Thing,
yes.
Was,
all right.
So anyhow, today... I'll try and round off this 169-page essay. With just, now, it's because there's so much and stuff. It's the extracts from extracts.
Yeah.
It's called From Gustav Moreau to Kazimir Malevich.
Oh, this is your ongoing lecture,
last two.
which we had sort of episodes of this over the months.
And we've had certain insertions. We've had people
indeed
arriving.
That's right. Yes, there was a sort of false start, wasn't there? Yeah.
There was one at the gallery where I came a week early, and you said we'll do it anyhow.
Yeah.
And then the following week, when we did it, you had a
Paul Robertson came in. And it was a sort of double booking, I think. You kind of came along as well. But that was okay. And Jerry Smith, you were in with Jerry Smith as well.
Yeah.
But it worked out quite well.
It did.
It got quite a lively debate going.
I managed to get him hot under the collar about something.
Taking up,
which is quite good.
Well, he took you on quite well, I think.
No, we both had... We addressed... in the Michael Footman of the strength of each other's arguments,
right.
Or in the great successor, Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
But I just, as an introduction to Malevich, and I can't think of anything more Malevichian than the recent article in the Scientific American. Is it all right if I just talk? Because I usually play...
Yeah, we've got no music today.
No music, guys.
So it's an hour...
just talking.
Concentrated Bob Parks for an hour.
Hope that's all right.
Indeed.
Sound.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
People do those sort of things, don't they? Yeah. This is the quote, our sense of the universe is as an orderly expanse where events happen in absolute locations is an illusion. So it's all about non-locatedness. And... he's got an article coming up, which I want to... It's not published yet, Scientific American. Spooky Action at a Distance, the phenomenon that reimagines space and time and what it means for black holes, the Big Bang and theories of everything. So I can't wait to see that. Anyhow, he says at a deeper level, there may be no such thing as place and no such thing as distance. So the idea... of non-locality is the word here doesn't mean anything anymore. There is no here. And in quantum physics, as my the first person I stay overnight with, who was with Al Odger as a kid, who went to Downing College in Cambridge.
Yeah,
we would. I just reminded him of something last night when we were little kids. Well, in puberty, he'd say, because we used to get our roller skates on and go around the block.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, just imagine if you came across an area of nothing, what would happen? And I mentioned it to him yesterday, and he said, there's two things that can happen. He just started being, he's in his 80s now. He said, as you sort of go into the space, you'll sort of disappear into nothing. And you probably won't come out. That's about it. Or the other possibilities is you'll go in, and the bit that disappears will at the time it disappears, it will come out the other side. So it's one. I said, well, I'd prefer the latter to the former to happen. I just read a couple more quotes if I can see it. I've got the mic in front of me, and I can't see with my glasses. Let me just see if I can find a little bit. It's the idea of transcending space and the peculiar synchronicity of particles. Or he calls it spooky action at a distance, or sparkling with non-local phenomenon. Our minds have to overcome a hurdle of abstraction, yet we catch indirect glimpses. Now, this is about, in everyday life, distance and location are mundane absolutes. Yet, physics now suggests that at the most fundamental level, the universe is non-local. There is no such thing as place or distance. And Einstein's general theory of relativity introduced the deeper sense of non-locality by showing that space-time positions have no intrinsic meaning. I guess in relation to each other, there is such a thing as location. So, you know, because of tectonic forces, and you're living in California, where here is 5 years later, we'll be here 10 yards down the road because the San Andreas, the tectonic plates are moving the continent. So here is relative. But in this relative sense, well, there's this idea that I think in an African village, someone gave a metaphor that it got like plowed down by developers and everyone was going around in confusion because their mind worked in relation to the position of each hut.
Oh, yes.
And without that as a constant, they had no idea of how to orient myself. So just one last kind of little quote from it, if I can make this. I'll say this a bit at the end. General relativity confounds our intuitive picture of space as a kind of container in which material objects reside and forces us to search for entirely new conceptions of place. Well, I read a book about what is place. Mm-hmm. And one of the ideas is that, which I think seems to be a rather good one, is actually where you're born, that is where place is, because that's where your consciousness...
Where were you born?
South or Middlesex in 10 Argyle Avenue.
So are you drawn back there?
Yeah, I think it's a part of your almost hard wiring.
Indeed, yeah.
It's a part of your...
I think a lot of people, as they get older, for some reason, they are drawn back to the place perhaps they were born. I mean, I do know of a few people that are sort of have gone back to live where they were born, having spent, you know, decades elsewhere.
Well, the Aboriginal, it comes from the Aboriginal sense that life is animated by human presence. And when there isn't human presence, sort of not that it dies, but it sort of brings it into a...
So would you go back to Southall?
I do regularly, and I've always... I taught there for 20 years special needs. But no, it's... Yeah, because I went back actually to 17 Shackleton Road where I was born, and they let me come in.
Right.
And although people say Southall has changed dramatically over the last 4 or 5 decades...
Did they know you were coming?
No, I was hanging outside. I was 3 days outside doing a drawing, and I think they kept on looking out. Why is this person sitting outside our house for 3 days drawing? They said, well, why don't you come in? I said, well, thank you very much. And I recognised the stairs and all the bonks and all the...
But how did you, when they opened the door, did you say why you were there?
I said, I used to live here, sort of.
And they took that on board? They just kind of accepted that?
Yeah.
How many owners had the house had since you left?
Don't know. These were West Indian, African Caribbean.
Yeah.
And they went to live in New York. They might, and this was about 15 years ago, so there have been four or five generations have lived there.
Oh, really?
It changes a little bit, but there was the wall between mine... 17 and 19 Shackleton, and Jeff Jensen lived there with his sister, and he was part of a gang. And he used to climb it up. He used to like put his feet on one side of the wall and his back against the and edge his way up right up to the 20 foot up the thing that used to be very.
So you got into the house, and then did you try and find the room?
I didn't need to because I went straight at the front door.
Yeah,
as a little boy, I used to crouch under the. letterbox when the Beano and the Dandy were being, and as the postman, as a newspaper man came, because they used to have newspapermen there. He'd put it in. I sort of pulled it out the other side. But that was the Big Event Comics.
Yeah.
Where I've already said what's happened to Guy Fawkes Night and now comics as well. Yeah, I don't know what's happening.
Do they still produce comics?
I think the Dandy and the Beano.
Are they still going?
Yeah.
Crikey. Yeah, I haven't seen them for a long time.
No, it's big business.
So, has the door changed? Does the door look the same?
Can't remember. Front garden's the same. The crazy paving. My dad had a Morris Minor that he used to about 20 moves and park it inside it off the street.
Yeah,
and we used to move the fence back and forth when he finished working.
So how was it when you got inside the house? Was there a sense of nostalgia?
I studied method acting with Lee Strasberg, didn't I? And you know, anything of. You work sensorially. All the exercises when I was living in Hollywood for 10 years at the method acting things, you work for places that you remember as a child. I'll give you example. Mm-hmm. Is Canvey Island, where we used to go on holiday, which is in the film, because it's like Thames Delta, which is where the English blues, to my opinion, Dr. Phil couldn't go. Anyhow, we upstairs, it was my grandfather's and grandmother's house, and in the 1953 flood it got sort of everything was covered, but it was still there. That's when we started going. My mum used to go there pre-war, and they've got a wind-up gramophone. I think it was these coloured 78s they played. Which one was the man on the flying trapeze? I remember that one. Anyhow, so I was working sensorially to create this wind-up radio, back to sort of pre-pubescent memories, to get right back into my soul and Stanislavski's motivation and all that kind of stuff. And I was winding the clockwork handle up.
Yeah,
and spend a little, and then I looked around, and the chair looked to be about 3 foot tall. I couldn't make it out, and I realised, when you're sort of two foot tall, everything looks enormous.
Much bigger.
And I'd gone back, I'd regressed.
Oh,
so I was seeing literally through those. I mean, because you can.
Yeah,
it's a construct, how a child's eye view of it, or whatever.
So this was at Canvey Island.
Yeah, no. This was when I regressed. In my sessions at Lee Strasberg in Hollywood, recreating it.
Okay.
So I'd worked on the room. I knew all the sensorially. I knew all the rooms in my head because I'd done the work, right?
Yeah.
So when I went into it, it's about right.
So going back to Southall. Then,
yeah, this is it.
You get into the house, and so what happened then?
Well, I went into all the places that I'd explored in my sensory lessons. In Strasbourg, I went into the front room where the piano was and the fireplace. And I'll tell you, this is just one story. Uncle Bob was there and he was fiddling around because we had an immersion heater behind the fire. The fire used to warm up the hot water for the bath.
Yeah.
And here he was fiddling with it.
Yeah.
And he took it off and this gush of hundreds of gallons of water flooded out. And then the next thing I saw of him in the attic, because you have to go upstairs, and I think Dad had taken the ladders away. You just saw these legs dangling underneath the... And just sort of childhood memories come sort of flooding back with these...
Why do you think you went back to this house in Southall? What drew you back, do you think? What's the point of going back to the house you were born in?
Well, there's something, I don't know, it's about authenticity or something like that. Well, what actually it is which is the theme of the film, and a project, this is the project, bringing me back to this project I want to do at Villiers High. In the 60s, there was a strong R&B scene in London, and the Ealing Club, which was opposite Ealing Broadway Station, was where the Cyril Davis All-Stars and Alexis Corner started out, so that was one of the seminal R&B kind of locations. And also there was a group called Hog Snort Rupert, and they were ex-Farnham, and if anyone in Radioland knows about this group or has seen them, or has parents or grandparents who've seen it, please would you mind through William contacting me, because part of the project I want for the kids to do, they played at the Ricky Ticky Club in Windsor, is to research this group, because they never recorded, but it's a seminal R&B band, alto, tenor sax, keyboard, guitar, bass, and they hold their guitars up high like the old blues players did, and the drums, and it's just like I just love to hear that sound. And it's early 60s, and it's really so. I always identify my youth because it was just music coming from Generation X.
Yeah,
we grew up with pop and that kind of stuff, and I'm an avid listener to Sounds of the 60s on Saturday morning with Brian Matthew, because that's what we used to lay in bed on Saturdays up till 10 o'clock listening to, and that was our contact with what was happening. Actually, I didn't listen. I'd never heard Elvis Presley till I went to the local fair, fun fair in Southall Park.
Oh, yeah.
And I learned there's a movie, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. I think it's Albert Finney. And in it, there's a scene in the fairground.
Right.
That's Southall Park. Yeah. That's the one in Southall Park, you see.
Is it? Well, that's set in Nottingham, isn't it?
I know, but they went to Southall Park. Because it was one... I was going through the old fair, and somebody said they remembered that they'd filmed that. So it was like...
I think he works in a factory, doesn't he? And I remember there's a neighbour who gossips, and I think he shoots her from behind with an air gun.
Ah.
Do you remember that scene?
No, I don't remember the scene, but it's just...
she's suddenly... Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
We should move on.
So there you go, man. And anyway, so this is the vibe. That's the R&B vibe. Teddy Bear and All Shook Up.
Oh, yes.
I don't want to be here. And that was it. And that was the first time I heard that really sort of dangerous music.
Right.
And I wore my suede jacket with a zip.
Well, the sound of fun fairs was quite extraordinary, wasn't it?
Yeah, because, the teddy boys and all that kind of thing.
Well, it was the volume as well, and the kind of huge sort of mono speakers,
lights,
I suppose.
And the Dodgem cars.
And it would echo across the fields or whatever, wouldn't it? Across the landscape.
Yeah, well, it was a big event once a year, and it was always often in the winter time.
Yeah.
Around, well, it was the beginning of winter, which was the most fun time of year anyhow.
Right.
And so this is... The project I want to bring to the kids is to get... This is the ambience. The second thing... Well, the first element is Robert Irwin, who's on right now at White Cube, but... Where is it? Bermondsey. And he's, to me, the seminal Californian artist. He, more than anyone, coined the term installation art, and I think it was probably late 50s or early 60s in the Chicago Museum. He put a layer of scrim in a gallery and changed the perception of... space. So he's got a phenomenological approach to perceptual psychology, and that's the root of all the Ferris gallery artists and everything. Larry Bell, and he also had a show at just a few months before at the other White Cube Gallery, and so on. But so I want them to research that and then to find this Malevich drawing that I'd seen at the Peggy Guggenheim when I was at school and discovered the Tate.
Is it the Robert Irwin show? Does that finish soon, did you say?
It finishes up, I think, on the 13th of November. So
it's quite a while,
So they can catch it.
There's an amazing sort of glass column, isn't there?
Two
glass columns next to each other.
They're not glass, they're resin.
Oh, really?
And that was part of his fetish.
Ah.
I mean...
Because it looks like it's going to fall over. You can't quite believe it stands up.
Well, he's rooted it in the floor a little bit.
Right.
But he does, his installation is like to the thousandth of the inch. So you get like something like, what's his name? Who's the English artist? Anish Kapoor.
Oh, right.
He's kind of a poor man's Robert Irwin he was in the Jet Propulsion Lab. He met a technologist there with Terrell. And they had these weekly meetings following the art and technology show at the Wiltshire.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 1960 with Rauschenberg and all the molten mud and all that art and technology thing, County Museum. And senior moment.
That's
I've got
right.
quite a long way into the programme, haven't I, before?
Yes, all right.
So what I want them to do, coming back to the Malevich drawing, which started... I mean, I was knocked out by Kandinsky and Archipenko's boxing forms and all that kind of stuff. But it was a little suprematist drawing with just a couple of rectangles, actually. And it had such a power. And it fazed me for the rest of my life. I just can't get away from that. What is it about it? And so I want them to go back, archive at the Tate, that catalogue, and find page 33 and 34 and reference to, i.e. contact the gallery Guggenheim in Venice and get them to scan the thing. And then they'll have the information to create a performance. Now, Jenny, you're hearing all the stuff before the lesson, so anyhow, if you're listening, that is, but don't be fazed by it, because I've got the project with the kids is, I've got Jenny, they're going to prepare sort of a whole bunch of boxes, and they've put white emulsion inside with just a whole plethora of any materials, basically, with one open side, and just to experiment with their own installation. So to get a feeling for what it is. But I'm hoping that it would develop into possibility of actually creating a for real installation somewhere in Villiers Height, and for our group to perform there, maybe on the same day that the television program of the movie goes out, which is next April, to sort of coincide with that. So, but it's like the perfect the teaching project that I was never able to teach because I was in special needs for 20 odd years, but I could never apply anything that I had to bring, you know, like my shows. Everything I come along with, you're more than grateful for me to share with everyone. It was the exact antithesis, and I can't say the word, the opposite of that, at teaching, that whatever I wanted to do wouldn't be possible or practicable. And you know, I came from the Institute of Education and the university with a conceptual approach to teaching art. Oh, you want to forget all that rubbish. Just do it. It's all gibberish.
Just to go back to Southall, having got to this room, were you born there in this house?
I was literally born there. My mum was born in another house just down the road.
Having visited the room, was that it then? You could leave the room and that was it? You don't want to keep going back there?
No, I do go back and I just sort of go past it. Well, it's a psychic thing, isn't it? It's where there's voodoo. Overtones of it, you know, and it's your traces there, you know, your ghost, if you like, or your doppelganger or whatever it is, coexists. It is from that part of the earth. I think there's a sort of magic in relation to place, and you know, identity, basically, and so to reaffirm and reconfirm. A sense of self-assurance, because I've got an enormous inferiority complex that I got from my mum. To compensate from that, it's you could get it rooted. I mean, what happened, the vicar, or retired vicar, in Sway, where I moved in the New Forest, that's another story, but anyhow, let's go right back to the... oh, yes, Bob, oh, wonderful, wonderful, anything I do. Yes, that's marvellous. So I got him to come round to see the film. And he was noticeably quiet afterwards. He didn't listen to it. But anyhow, he said a prayer to me. And he said a prayer to God's face, you see. And I thought, well, afterwards, I meditated on that prayer. And I got Mum's face for God's face. And as a consequence of that, I've got Mum back with me, which is, you know, unconditional support. So if I've got anything, God, do that. Do it, Bob. Do that. It's the same. Do it. Anything's good. Just go. So I've got that continually backing me up as my inner voice now.
Right.
Which is what
do you think? What was it about the film that bothered the vicar, do you think? Why was he?
Well, it was also, I can talk, if I use not rude words, I can talk about the issue of it, can't I? The issues that we dealt with. But just put a hand up if I'm getting into areas that was...
Sure.
The area that I made the contact with him originally was about my mum's ashes. And I go into that? Anyhow, there was an issue about that which was very controversial.
Yes.
And he said, oh, no, you need blood. You know, so I went out to Los Angeles to abattoirs to get blood, you see, as a part of it, to anoint the idea that we can't talk about. Yeah. And it's legal, you know, can't do it.
Right.
And it wasn't Nietzsche, it was one of those German actionists. I went to one of the things he did at the Whitechapel, which is all these buckets of blood, you know, so he was able to get it. But maybe, ever since foot and mouth or whatever, people have got a bit or whatever it is.
Is that right? So you can't just go and get a bucket of blood?
Not from an abattoir. No. Well, you may be in England, you can. You certainly can't in America.
Oh, right.
So I couldn't use the blood. But anyhow, so he was more far out than me. So I thought, well, he's going to love this film, you see.
Yeah.
But I think what it was the same thing when, because, you know, I've got my church from Tottenham figure quite highly in the film, because it's a gospel feeling, which for me, blues and jazz, not for me, but from I've had reported back to me, gospel music, blues and jazz are different soul beats of gospel music. This is the origin of American soul music, basically, and the African Caribbean community bought it over with the Windrush in the 50s. And Sir Geoffrey, Pastor Geoffrey, was coming out to see the film. We did the screening in Soho, which you came to, you remember.
Yep.
And so it was that last scene,
yes.
not the thing there, but the thing in the shop on Hollywood Boulevard I mean, in LA,
what happens
what
in
it is,
scene?
There's a whole bunch of these shops selling psychic wares stuff like that. But they're all Spanish and they're all, you know, they're Catholic, basically. So it's part of the whole bag of Los Angeles. So it's not quite so shocking. And they're not, they're pretty strong.
Yeah.
Word of God, Bible bashers, you know, they're not sort of particularly aberrant or anything like that. But anyway, he was particularly worried about this scene because it maybe didn't represent or present a case of God as he saw it. So there are different elements in the film that are rather kind of, who knows? But anyway, I thought, well, I won't be able to make it out of the door before I get into trouble with the church. But anyhow, it's there and it's out, and so all of that, so
he wasn't troubled by the last scene then?
Possibly.
The last 10 minutes, because that seems to be the most controversial.
Do you think so? Well, that's wonderful if it is, because I've never had my work, I was one of the first performance artists in the 60s, I've never had it archived, and then the whole movie in a way is an archive. It's like the build-up to the 5 minutes, 10 minutes, the last 10 minutes, which is a sort of précis of the thing that we did. That thing I wanted to do with John Altenbridge, who was one of the sort of cool school, was going to organise with people in Watts, and we were going to do... Anyhow, they found this hillside in Los Angeles, waste. I don't know how they found it, but it had a 360-degree panoramic view of the whole of... But the point was, it overlooked East LA. Okay. So I thought, well, I'm going to get killed. There's going to be a drive-by and, you know, someone with the antics that I was doing. Anyway, what we did was the mum's ashes, I put them in a cross and put it on a painting with a sort of a Russian cross, and then we constructed a sort of altar out there and took all my clothes off and poured colours over. And really, what that was about reconnecting with mum's spirit and coming out of the thing. There were sexual things in but it wasn't that wasn't specific, I suppose. But so I don't see the controversy. There's a bit of nakedness, and it wasn't that apparently. You found it wide.
I won't go into a full description. There is a bit more to it than that.
No, I couldn't do that. That was the thing that didn't happen, because those sort of things, they have to be... I wasn't working for that. That was the other one that I wanted to do. So that was, it wasn't... Well,
so having gone back to Southall, you go back to this room, and that's it then. You feel like you've done what you wanted to do. You touch base, as it were.
Well, it's a spiritual thing, because as you know, I'm 100% spiritual. And these are things, these are touchstones that you have to...
Right.
Once you've touched base, so to speak,
yeah,
it releases something in you. And then the next stage is release. It's a sort of internal...
You think it's a good thing to do? I mean, do you think most...
No, I don't think... I think it transcends the sense of good or bad. It's the thing to do,
but is it
good or bad.
But does it make you feel better? You feel better
for having
done it?
It's fulfilling. It gives you access.
Hmm.
Well, me and my mum, which is why I can't start... And I'll come back to yesterday in a minute, is this idea of Gustave Moreau. He said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like, what's internal is incontestably real, whereas what... is external is a sort of ephemeral. So his reality was his inner reality, just as it was with Gustave Courbet earlier, who coined the term the inner voice, who said that if I go a thousandth of an inch away from my inner voice, let me be struck dead on the spot. So he responded to inner directives, and this was a new direction that then led to the Impressionism and the whole thing. It was a sort of break from the outer to the inner, and that was sort of the development out of the 17th century Dutch genre painting.
Yeah.
Before that, the humanism of the Renaissance and the portrait. The whole it's a internal move to the internal, to the personal, increasingly through the centuries. Yeah. Now we're seeing it in sort of almost in consciousness.
Is there something very sad about going back?
Yeah, I love the melancholy, because that's the thing about these tunes that I like from that time. They're all really sad and melancholic.
Right.
And that's what I'm looking for. Is that element that if it's not there, it's a pretty much no interest to me. It's got to have the sadness.
Uh-huh.
And I don't sort of...
Why do you think it's sad? What's sad about going back to where you were born?
Well, I'll tell you the lyrics. There's a song I like, The Sea of Heartbreak by Don Gibson. Yeah. Shall I sing it?
You all right?
Okay. I can't do it again. The lights in the harbour don't shine for me. I'm like a lost ship adrift on the sea. The sea of heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear, across the sea of tears, sea of heartbreak. It came out in 61. And I thought, wait a minute, I recognise something in it. That's my life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. That means I'm not going to have any relationships. And I haven't had any relationships since Miriam left me in 1974.
Right.
I mean, no big deal, because I've had enough going on in my life, but I haven't really had any relationships. And it really is a story of my life, which is, in a sense, sad.
Why do you, do you think about that?
Well, it's in the genes again, because my mum wasn't loved in the way that she needed to be loved. You know.
But your parents stuck together, didn't they?
Well, the dad raped her when she was going through her change.
All right.
But the thing about that, is that right?
No, yeah, it's all right. Yeah,
okay. The thing that was earlier, my dad was in the army in the Second World War, and he was in the Royal Engineers, and he had a lorry.
Yeah.
And there was a scene where in India he had the killing kind of dysentery, the killing kind of malaria, and it was going on the boat out to Singapore, which fell. Had it not have fallen, he'd have been on the Burma Railroad and we wouldn't be here.
Right.
So anyhow, there was this, in the back of his lorry, there was an Indian woman, there was a line of English soldiers raping her and queuing up to it. And he got his gun out and he said, you know, his rifle, and, you know, back up, guys, because I'm a pacifist. And that was the only reason I could think for force, and I quite admired that stance that he took. And then here, lo and behold, he raped my mum. So I don't know the full circle of the thing.
But they stuck together.
Well, my mum, yeah, because that was then, wasn't it? That's what people did,
you know,
because she would be obliged by the marriage vows.
Right,
she wasn't loved in the way that she.
So any idea why you haven't had a relationship, a lasting relationship?
Because in the genes, you know, I think it's this sense of inferiority complex, and just, you know, a relationship, it's. Sexual intercourse is a blessing. It's not a right. And that was my mum's. And sexual intercourse is spiritual, basically. It's the most intimate act between two human beings. Mm. And it's holy, almost. It's sacred.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my mum held that in really high, you know, as the highest point. And she was very open. I mean, in the film she goes on about, as Solomon Burke comes out, and she said, well, wonder what it would look like without any clothes on, and that kind of thing. So she had a mischievous side about her. And a sense of fun. Mm. So I don't know. I think something about melancholy engenders a sense of fun. It's almost accompanying thing.
Right.
And it's like that vibe when you're into that area. Maybe melancholy is the white equivalent of blues, which is the art form to come, which actually is behind jazz, really. It's a blues formation. So that's what I'm fascinated in, and how that communicates, which is to do with life is very difficult.
I find sometimes these days that the blues actually doesn't really sound melancholy anymore.
No, exactly. It's lost. It's lost its sadness.
Whereas there are tracks by Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
Which are almost
insufferably depressing. It's outrageous. Well, I've got to tell you the story. Yeah. Leonard Cohen was playing in Bournemouth at the Civic Centre. Benny King was on at the Winter Gardens, and Leonard Cohen was at the, I don't know, bit up market.
Yeah.
And his tickets were £70 and Benny King's were £40.
Right.
And Leonard Cohen had a blues band, everything. Yeah. And poor old Benny King had this second-rate backing group that, you know, couldn't play his tunes properly.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was the man who brought strings in and brought the, you know, that particular thing in.
Yeah.
And the irony of it is he's never had, just as Roy Orbison never had someone to back him that would bring out the full pathos of his music. Yeah. I don't know why that happens, but that was just the way that they don't get it, I guess, the people around him.
Right.
So it's just that incidence of having the right people at the right place at the right time, which is, it's kind of going for a perfect relationship, which is kind of like a spiritual relationship, and you don't settle for anything else, and you know when it's there, and if it's not there, you just hold out till it comes along.
Right.
Okay, let me just say a little bit of this is Malevich. I'll put this thing down so I can see it a bit. Here we go. But now this is a letter to his wife. He says, Natashenka, that's what they say in Russian, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Don't smoke, dearest. Don't cram up our separation with smoking. Drop it and let your heart yearn the way mine does without smoking or vodka. It's better that way. So it's like making the best of what you have. And my mum was very good with money. You know, she didn't have very much, but she made it last, and we never went without food or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a responsibility. And there's, I think, an integrity. It says here, he did not take the path the majority took. He did not like bowing down to what the majority bowed down to. He always unrestrainedly strove ahead to the new, as yet unknown. He was unable to create material well-being for himself right up to his death because he thought completely independently. Only now have I realized the spiritual grandeur of life. And the further I go, the more the grandeur thrills me. And he was indignant through, because I've got his selectoritis. He is, if he's anything, he's spiritual. And he made an, you know, man is located in heaven, but when looking from Mars, the earth is also in the heavens. And he says about the patriarchy will become the high point from which he must fall. His fall will be into himself, into his spiritual heaven. His spirituality must go further. He must go beyond its orbit and find himself in the abyss once again. That is, in his own heaven, himself being God. And he goes on to say, I understand conscious objectlessness, because this is the link with this original, the world is objectlessness, the link with this quantum physics idea of non-location. I think they're very comparable ideas. And in the world is objectlessness, he makes the point that objects at any level don't exist. And this is the case for abstraction, which is it can only suggest form. When it states form, it negates its validity. So at best, art can only suggest what is there. It can never state it because it's unstatable. That's why he said the world is objectlessness. So when it moves through consciousness, in the latter, the form of material is the form of consciousness, which is materialist nature. A material man, a suprematist city does not consist as a mass of little homes and gardens, but can confine itself in a single suprematist form, like a skull protecting the brain. So he sees like the brain. And to link in Robert Irwin here, Robert Irwin, he said in seeing something is seeing is forgetting the name of the thing you see. That's the name of his biography, Maxwell Schendler. I can't remember the, I should know his name, Morris Tauschman. Mm-hmm. His drug. Robert Irwin lived out his curiosity. So like you got something like Mailer's Advertisements for Myself, his best books were his sort of late 50s, The Deer Park, and when he talks about American existentialism. Essentially, he says that the hipster is the homosexual, the black, the poet, or whatever, and that the French form of existentialism. Actually, I just got a postcard of Simone de Beauvoir at the ICA today. But she said the thing that I got. It's a slight digression, but she said of what's the word? What is it? Man had transcendence, but women had immanence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like Stanley Spencer and Max Beckman, they took away, they even had the transcendence, but they took women's immanence, and then they had that sense of immanence in their...
What do you mean by immanence? Do you know, can you describe that?
Well, I suppose that's what phenomenology is is a sense that is a reporting of what's there. Mm-hmm. Exactly what's there, the phenomenon of there, of being there, as opposed to being somewhere else or different. I mean, being a nothingness, the Sartre begins with, you know, I look at this inkwell, I turn my head away, and the inkwell ceases to exist, which is the existential stance, which is Irwin went into, he rejected Sartre and went into Merleau-Ponty and was more of a phenomenological approach to I know Sartre and de Beauvoir had a relationship, and there was some, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I find her very clear about her thinking, very easy to comprehend. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was trying to make Malevich. A point from that.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to do, I've got a whole bunch of quotes. You know, I'm just going to get little snippets from that, which I might get onto. But there's a couple of things I want to do because I've got in. Where's my blummy? Somewhere under here, I've got a notebook. There it is. There it is. And I've noted, down. Where is it? Where's the page then? I don't know. Oh, here you go. Just things I wanted to cover because I thought, well, why not?
Do you want to have a drink?
It's empty.
Is it empty? Do you need more water?
Yeah, send for water.
I'll get some more water.
Okay, I'll carry on while you're gone.
You talk as though I'm not. As though I'm still here.
He's not. He really is here, but he's just pretending. He's just winding everybody up. So sort the book in the locker. No, that's what I've got to do at work. Right, my performance. I've got this performance that I want to do in Sway, and it involves. Two donkeys and Mum's oak tree where she we spread her ashes, and the lady just down the road has got two donkeys that we can use. One of the text I'm going to use is a post-structuralist text, What Animals Can Teach Us About Politics, and the second one is I've lost it. I got halfway through the book and then I left it on a bus, so I can't get the quotes from it, but he was a Heideggerian German leading philosopher. Right now he's about the same age as me actually, and it's part one spheres. This one, part one, is bubbles, and actually he talks about Mesmer, who comes into a play, but out of this film, the movie, which is about my life story. I want to do a movie called Mass Psychosis. Because I don't believe there's been any. Did I talk about this last time?
Vaguely, yeah.
Okay, just to pick up the point, I don't believe there's been any original thinking since the First World War. Because if people are stupid enough on a global level to kill each other, anyone who's got any sort of thought going on in their brain doesn't want to use that particular part of themselves anymore. So there really hasn't, and I think there's evidence by the abstract expressionists just rehashed really what the Russians said. Done at the time of the revolution, abstract expressionism was really a reshaping of that. It's easy to do, but no one can do it because it's sort of gone out. We haven't access to it. We don't need it, so it's not there, sort of thing. So we just need to find the right God and say a few prayers and bring the forces out again.
But I left the room, but I heard something about two donkeys. What's
this? This is there's a post-structuralist book on. What animals have to teach us about politics, and I've used that in reference. So I've got a text I want to read out from that.
All right,
and then a text which is to do with Mesmer. Is arguing the case for plant life and plant consciousness, and so I think when he was working in Paris, he had a studio in Paris, early 19th century. There's these scenes of tying these women, well, having ropes coming out from yew trees. And it was to do with a connection with it. You know, his thing was magnetism, and this is to do with natural magnetism. It's used in contemporary neurology. Actually, it's something cranial something. It's a term, and he's quite relevant in his application of magnetism. And there were sort of insights that he had at that time. So anyhow, that's using it in relation to plants. And,
have a drink.
Oh, thank you, Rich. And then the third one, I want to put my movie on as a third element in it.
Right.
Just for the villagers to see, so I can show the people in the village the film. So that's a performance that I'm hoping. I'm going to see some two MA students because Artsway lost its funding. And anyhow, the MA course at Bournemouth College of Art has taken over from it, and the students are meeting there. Anyhow, I talk to them, and they're interested. So if I can, from the inside, get it interested, I might be able to get the gallery and through their use of it, not have to hire it myself because it's a lot of money and I can't really afford it, through the art school, cover two things with one thing. So I get the art school into it, but I also get the villagers into it, and have the three things happening at the same time. So that's it. Anyhow, this film, Mass Psychosis, and the thing I wanted to touch upon was two awarenesses, and it's sort of two areas. Closing my eyes, I can't see William, I better not do that. the first is, there's three aspects. The first, let's go back to the fin de siècle, because I believe that's what we have to return to, is the fin de siècle, the thinking. There's two people who were sort of founding fathers of totalitarianism, which was the title of the essay, with one being Malevich and another D'Annunzio, I'm aware of. And he obviously went on to inspire Hitler and Mussolini and to overtake Rijeka in Yugoslavia. He formed a fascist state there, I think, before the Second World War. Out of that, that's power. And out of that is force. That's the way that, you know, by insurrection and murder and everything, that's the way that dictatorships have been put into place. In the other side of it, I mean, and Malevich took over Chagall's art school in Vitebsk and kept it going right into the 30s in Stalinist Russia. So he must have had something going for him to be able to keep an avant-garde place going like that. And he was... because it was using aims and objectives when they meant something, because they were the voice of the people, not what they have become in teaching, which is meaningless. But they meant something. And because they meant something, they were the impetus that kept it going. So he literally changed, rather than being dictatorial in that sense. So that aspect of it isn't power and force, but it's energy. And there's a physics thing. Power equals energy over time, or power equals time over energy. So there is an inverted relationship between them. And out of in energy, what sources that is enthusiasm, which is a human capacity. And it's my belief that my psychosis that I've been going through for these last 30 years, which has left me with the death of my mum, I won't go into that, but we've touched on it in earlier talks anyhow. And this is kind of a link with Malevich, which also links in. There's a show on of the Eames, Ray and Charles at the Barbican right now. And the Eames house in Santa Monica, and what they were using was process, not in a dissimilar way to the way that Stravinsky used it in The Rites of Spring, i.e., he'd have a phrase, and then he'd bring another phrase in, and then bring a third phrase in, then move on to a different phrase, and then build up like that. And process isn't dissimilar in as much as it's a riff. You get a riff going, and then basically you...
You didn't catch the show in The Curve at the Barbican, did you?
No, I didn't see that one. Oh, okay. Which is that?
Oh, no, it's all right. No.
Okay. Anyhow, to bring that round is... these are the three elements. Kokoschka in Fin de Siècle, I got a bit off track by that, was paintings... paintings, essentially, so I shouted into the thing.
Right.
I just thought it went into my head. That had psychological intent. Now, here we come a little bit late. It's a very good Giacometti show on at the Royal Academy right now, but there's a bigger one coming 2 years' time, the Tate Modern, really comprehensive, which I can't wait for. But anyhow, this is good. It's all about presence. So he went for something more complex, and he used painting, drawing, and sculpture. So he extended. So he tried to get a sense of presence. So post-war Paris, anyhow, was all existential, and it's the presence of the thing. Now, I'm going for something even more difficult in my work, which includes psychosis, because in performance art, well, performance art is psychosis to me. It's the same thing. It's you going into a sort of a... Another word for it is the active subconscious, where your subconscious takes rule over everything, and you just... There are no limits once that happens, because it's dream world that dictates things, which has no bearing on relationship to sort of... Well, it does have an indirect relationship, but not a traceable to consciousness. It's subconscious. Yeah. It's broad. So my portraits are ones trying to capture process, which is computer consciousness. So each artist at each era reflected the dominant mood of the time, what was in the air, basically. So Kokoschka picked up psychology because it was just coming in. Giacometti picked up existentialism because it was just coming in. I'm picking up computer technology because that's of the moment, and that's our responsibility. Just as like the.
But I wouldn't see any evidence of computer technology in your work.
No, but it's what's behind it. It's the thinking behind it.
You're basically a painter, aren't you? You're a painter and
painting and sculpture. Yeah. My degree is in painting and sculpture. Right. So
you don't actually use the computer technology as such.
I do.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's.
All right.
Well, it's the idea that the computer, when it came out, it was quite controversial with neurologists, that the computer would supersede the brain. And they were sort of, there was a lot of articles in various papers saying, you don't use, the Americans are falling backwards to give room to this. And they're doing the wrong thing. But anyhow, the point being, who's that guy who wrote Daniel... Oh, crikey, he wrote about A Definition of Consciousness, the American philosopher. Anyhow, I've got a whole bunch of his books, but he was saying that actually the computer is just a model by which we can understand the working of our brain. It's just, which is what, neurologists are going on to. So, I think, Suzanne was the first artist to try to directly address brain processes. To supersede not just visual but actually touch, and this is an area I think a frontier that most of the arts are focusing on right now, which is directly working with brain processes. And computer is the most direct sensor, so in that sense I'm working with it in as much as it's working with thoughts rather than words and so on. So that's the first aspect of it. Then the other aspect of it is Monet in the he went to Venice about the 20s or something, or a bit earlier than that, to retire, and he produced 50 paintings. And then after that, he went wild. He did all his free colour paintings. Because actually, had a slight defect in his eye, in his retina, that made him enhance colours, and he's actually painting what he saw. So it was a physiological thing. When I was with the kids, I tried to, teaching, I went to the local... Catholic church and said I want to do, because children basically at school are interested in sex and violence, and they're both taboo topics pretty much in education. So I wanted to motivate them, so I took them to the church, and the priest there said, we'll study evil, because that's what, and he addressed us to this. We visited a practicing exorcist. I got permission from the parents and from Cardinal Hume to do it, so it was all and we went to a seminary in Twickenham, and in there the guy had access to, he was a world leading expert on exorcism as it being recorded, and he said that he's been to all the Vatican papers and there's no record of where there is anything but compliance with the person who's being exorcised, i.e. they're saying this isn't happening to me, although it's happening to them. So it's like something from outside is happening. It's more subjective, all the reports. Right. And in this sense, both Monet was it was a thing that was happening to him that he couldn't help. And then Giacometti had a thing that, in his visual thing, elongated the figure. So he was, again, doing what he saw when he did these long figures. And my sense is my psychosis that I've been through, it has shaped my approach to art, and it's been, 200 or 300 of these. What are you doing? What are you looking
at? I'm looking at the clock.
Right, so I'm here. I'm just getting into this.
I haven't
read anything from this thing yet.
You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Bob Parks, whose film...
Can I do one last quote?
Yes.
If I can find it, because this is a beautiful quote.
I was going to take you back to Southall.
No, I don't want to go there. I want to go somewhere else.
Okay.
If I can find it.
You've got 1 minute.
Oh, boy.
It's all right. No, you've got...
Take your time,
10
to hurry
seconds
up.
To find your notes.
No. I've circled them.
I could always play the ticking clock.
It's...
You've got exactly 1 minute.
Oh, I can't find it.
That's right. Sing for a bit.
It's a wonderful quote. It's the guy who had double consciousness, and he was saying about. Let me just write this. Any problem? No, I don't know. La, 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 la. That's time. Sorry about that, guys.
We could do a duet, but I'm not singing.
Yeah, I don't know.
So that would have been.
I can't find it. Isn't
can
it?
You so, sing a duet on your own?
Yeah, I
can sort of double consciousness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hello.
Hello.
No, I can't do that. Okay, bye. Very well. Right. Oh, here it is.
Oh,
the history of the American Negro is the history of the of strife, the longing to attain self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better, truer self. In this merging, he wishes neither the
Thanks,
older.
Thanks, Bob. Oh. Bye. Okay.